Join the conversation in Tipperary. Contact us through Facebook, Twitter, or email tiptoday@tipfm.com.
Now, some people still inquiring about the Joseph O'Callaghan podcast. Again, if you Google that, you'll find those podcasts there, no problem. If you want to add Sunday World to Joseph O'Callaghan, it will guide you to where the podcasts are. 1800 938 007. Now, we've been following the progress of songwriter Seamus Doran's musical project centred around the centenary of the decade of revolution. The latest song in the collection tells the story of the great Sean Hogan, and we'll launch that song on the programme tomorrow. But ahead of that, and as part of our coverage of the events of the War of Independence, I spoke to historian John Connors at his home in Burrisaleigh about the great Sean Hogan.
Sean Hogan was born in the townland of Green Eyan. That would be the Dundrum side of Tipperary town. His father was a man called Matthew Hogan, and he farmed 38 acres there in the townland of Stoughorn, more popularly known as Green Eyan. Now, Matthew Hogan was a pretty well-to-do man. He was a member of the Board of Guardians in the workhouse in Tipperary town, for example, you know, which I suppose would be the equivalent of an urban council.
Yeah.
And he died in 1916. Now, just maybe to carry on for that, in 1916, Eamon Dwyer of Baddock, the famous nationalist, he took Sean Hogan under his wing, he did. And I suppose maybe that was the great influence on Sean Hogan's life. From that, the huge activity around Tipperary in that time is one of the big events was the coming of Eamon de Valera to Tipperary town after he won the by-election in County Clare. And Hogan was part of a group along with, organised by Sean Tracy, who acted as bodyguard for de Valera on that occasion. So this was a huge paramilitary display by the volunteers in Tipperary town. So Hogan was part of that. He was associated with Dan Breen, Sean Tracy, all of these fellas. And when the plans were being made to capture the Jellyknight at Solihull Beg, that ultimately led to what became known as the War of Independence, Hogan was a central part of that, despite his youth. And these people, these men, they used to meet in a little barn in Shanballymore, another town stand in that area, on another Hogan's farm, cousins of Sean Hogan. And that's where these plans were made. And it's referred to in Dan Breen's book as the Tin Hut on Hogan's farm. Just about the Tin Hut and all of that, that maybe there'd be some doubts, we say, over, you know, Hogan's credentials, maybe because of his apparent youth at the time. Now, Hogan had a deep involvement in all of this for this reason. We know this because he had a brother, Matthew, younger brother, Matthew, and Hogan's mother, she used to send young Matthew down with Billy Cans of tea and sandwiches and all this down to the Tin Hut for to feed the men when they were there. And she was, she also had some kind of a signalling device or method where she'd hang a sheet on the clothesline in a certain way that would warn the men in the Tin Hut when the police would be approaching her.
And then, of course, they got the go-ahead and the infamous day came and they were there. And he's part in that then?
Yeah, a big part in that. If you read Seamus Robinson's account or Dan Breen's account, you know, he was there when the two policemen were shot and lay dead on the road. Hogan and Breen jumped on the cart and they drove the horse on. They did, and they finally drove it to Carew's in Golden Gare, and that's where the explosives were hidden. Hogan was, there was no turning back for Hogan at that stage, and three of those men, they went on the run, as it was called at the time, and that was Dan Breen, Sean Tracy, with Sean Hogan. Seamus Robinson joined him later when it became apparent to him that he was highly suspected in connection with all of that. The famous dance in the Wires of Bannock, where Hogan had, I suppose you could say, maybe in keeping with his emerging or subsequent character, a love at first sight encounter, and which brought him to Mahon's of Anfield, which led to his capture. And the capture ultimately led to his rescue at Knocklong. And You know, we'll always associate Sean Hogan with the rescue at Dochlann. Without Sean Hogan, there'd be no rescue at Dochlann.
Right. And what a rescue it was.
What a rescue
and
it was.
And, of course, an amazing part of Irish history,
wasn't it? Amazing, but also pivotal and of huge importance. But what happened in Salah Head Bank was not universally popular.
Of course.
And Bishop Harty, he spoke vehemently against it, and Monsignor Ryan, the parish priest of Tipperary Town, at the funeral mass for MacDonald, he said there's a saying, he said, but Tipperary leads, Ireland follows. He said, but I hope it won't be the case on this occasion. He survived not long, uninjured. Hogan, Dan Breen, Sean Tracy and Robinson were amongst the first members of Collins' squad. Perhaps, maybe not that well known. Certainly, Dublin historians might like to think otherwise. But when Collins looked for men for a dangerous job, the four Tipperary men were the first to volunteer. And Hogan was centrally involved in that attack on Lord French.
After that, what else was he involved in? How else did he behave over the coming years? Because it was very turbulent years was to come.
Yeah, he was involved in the barrack attack on Rear Cross, Clarehan and Kilsheelan. He was also leader of number 2 flying column. Dinny Lacy was leader of number 1 flying column. The flying columns are celebrated in song and story and written lavishly on. But in general and overall, in the context of the War of Independence, they were pretty ineffective. They weren't there for a very long space of time. They were only there from November to March, November of 20 to March of 21, really. You know, and their sheer size, you know, 40 men roaming the countryside with weapons, carrying weapons, that was a non-runner in areas of martial law. But I think of Hogan, first of all, undoubted heroism. I've no doubt about that. These young men, they volunteered, you know, a large chunk of their young life, in Hogan's case, 5 years, to something that they believed in. So there was huge dedication and heroism there. The second thing I think of is the loss and sacrifice. Much was lost. You know, it wasn't all the heroism and the adulation. That was nothing. And the third, and I think this was the forgotten story of the War of Independence, is the wider impact, you know, on self, on family, on community. Hogan was he was taken prisoner in May of 23, and he was lodged in Mount JJ for 6 months. And when he was released, he sent a telegram to his future wife, Christine Butler. She was nursing in Manchester. Ironically enough, she was nursing veterans of the First World War. Hogan wrote a telegram. I suppose the brevity of words maybe is an indication maybe how much money he had in his pocket, or that perhaps he was a man who only spoke when need to speak.
Yes.
But it just consisted of simply, "Released today, Sean." 3 words.
Right.
So, Hogan he came back to Tipperary Town, Fran. He began to farm his farm. And, you know, you read, you know, newspaper reports at the time, like, he's doing pretty okay. He had his couple of stallions and his horses. And when he finally sold the place, he had 16 cows to sell. In 1934, he left the prairie, left Green Ann, and he moved to a place called Woodtown House near Rathby in County Meath, a big lab house. His mother went with him. He also began working with the Board of Works in Dublin. He had 2 jobs. He was supervisor of cleaners and also a head messenger in the houses of the Rochtas. He went from there to Selbridge. There he got involved in the stud horses and all of this. Again, did not last. I think it was maybe 1964. He left Selbridge suddenly. And he ended up in the home of his friend Seamus Robinson in Highfield Road in Dublin. Seamus Robinson's daughter, Dimple Brennan, she told me that she recalls him as a child. He said to himself, he mixed with nobody, that his mental health was fragile. It was actually shattered. You know, he couldn't bear any noise. Everything had cut open him.
Mm. Well, nowadays we'd call that post-traumatic stress.
Post-traumatic stress. Mm. From there, he went to... He got a flat in North Great George Street, the house where David Norris lives today.
Go on.
Right, at the top floor of that. And David Norris showed me the room there when I was researching that story. He was estranged, of course, from his wife and his family.
How did he die, John?
Christmas Eve of 1968, he collapsed and outside the door of his flat in North Great George Street, on the street. He had actually got a brain hemorrhage, and he was taken to Jervis Street Hospital. His wife was sent for, and she was formerly Christine Butler from Tincurry in Cahir.
Mm.
And she came along with her son, Sean. And from then, Dan Breen came about a half an hour after, and Sean Hogan died. And Dan Breen said to his widow, he said, "I always thought I'd be gone before Sean." They brought him back to Tipperary, Stevens's Day. A very small crowd attended the funeral, because what was on the paper was funeral arrangements later, so nobody knew.
Oh, wow.
A pouring wet day, only a handful of people there at St. Michael's Church to receive the remains. The next day, he was buried in St. Michael's Cemetery. It's one of the saddest things, I suppose, Fran, that I ever heard when I was interviewing anybody. Was I spoke to his niece, Joan Colbert, a daughter of Matthew Hogan's. It should be a niece of Sean Hogan's. And she told me that when the funeral was over, they went to McCormick's Hotel in Tipperary Town. And she went to the bathroom at some stage. And in the bathroom, she went to the wash hand basin to wash her hands. And as it happened, Sean Hogan's widow was using the wash hand basin right beside her. And Joan Colbert told me that Sean Hogan's widow, without looking left or right, but straight ahead and staring at the mirror, she just remarked to Joan, or anybody who cared to listen if they were there, she says, but wasn't that some waste of a life?
My God.
That inner turmoil that hunted him and haunted him all his life was something that was not recognised. There was no place for that in the New Ireland. We didn't want to hear about that. But there it was. And I think the life of Sean Hogan, to me, sums up that. So when I wrote my book about Sean Hogan, I wrote about that individual, I suppose, that one individual. But I think it's the story. It's the story of the untold story, which I think is something. It's something maybe... We go through the phases of history, maybe where we might maybe glamorise conflict, or maybe sometimes justify bloodshed, you know. But like, I think when we look at something like this, it teaches us a different lesson, like that there's a harsh reality behind it all, and that's why I think of all the things, the heroism, the sacrifice, but the wider impact is something we should never ever let go of.
Now there's very strong words and food for thought from historian John Connors speaking to me at his home in Burslea about the great Sean Hogan, and part indeed of our broadcasting on the War of Independence, 1800 938 007. Now we will launch the song written about Sean Hogan by songwriter Seamus Doran on the programme tomorrow. So we're looking forward to bringing that to you. News and information's on the way.
Tip FM's Tip Today with Fran Curry.
In association with Slattery's of Pecan, Tipperary's main Subaru dealer. Slattery's Garage Pecan, the name you can trust for over 50 years in the Premier County. Slattery'sGarage.ie.